everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. This is a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. And really, isn't that what it's all about? It's getting the knowledge so you make the choices, you make the decisions that are going to best support you. And I'm so glad you're joining me for this conversation today, because it's a really important conversation that I'll be having with my guest, Dr. Thomas Seyfried. But before we go there, I want to be sure, if you are listening for the very first time or if you've been tuning in for a while, to please access my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, just like me over there, because all of my shows are archived and then posted on my Facebook page. So that will ensure that you will get every single one of the shows. And, you know, I have a second show on Progressive Radio Network every Saturday at 11 a.m. Eastern Time called The Love Code. And that has more of a spiritual twist to it. And it's an uplifting show that actually allows us to tap into keys to living a healthy and connected life so we can truly be empowered in our journey of self-awareness. So if you'd like to get those shows, if you'd like to get the archive shows from What Women Must Know, you just have to go to my Facebook page, again, which is What Women Must Know, and like me there, and it'll pop up there every week. And you can also go to my website, which is drcherylselman.com, and if you opt in there, then I will be emailing you my shows, and that's another way to stay up to date with all these great conversations. So I want to introduce my guests, first of all. Dr. Thomas Seyfried is a professor of biology at Boston College and received his Ph.D. in genetics and biochemistry from the University of Illinois. Dr. Seyfried served with distinction in the United States Army's 1st Cavalry Division during the Vietnam War and received numerous medals and commendations. Dr. Seyfried published a groundbreaking treatise entitled Cancer is a Metabolic Disease on the Origin, Management, and Prevention of Cancer. The treatise provides extensive information showing that the cancer can be best defined as a mitochondrial metabolic disease rather than as a genetic disease. This new concept has implications for the development of new non-toxic cancer therapies, including the ketogenic diet. So we're going to be exploring cancer as a metabolic disease and many other chronic conditions that also could fall under the spell of being a metabolic disease. This is an important conversation, potentially a life-saving conversation, and it's such a pleasure to welcome Dr. Thomas Seyfried to the show today. So, hello and welcome to you, Dr. Seyfried.
Oh, thank you very much, Cheryl. It's nice to be here today.
You know, we spoke many years ago now. I mean, I was fascinated by your work many, many years ago, and I know you were a guest on the show. I can't even remember how many years in the past that's been. And I'm just so happy to have you back, because this topic and what you have researched and written about and investigated is really, it's like the cutting through so much of the misinformation to find a real profound understanding of what is generating chronic conditions such as cancer. So I'm just looking forward to the conversation and your ongoing research and what you are discovering, continue to discover, and recommend to people. So I want us to start by asking you, how did you arrive on your journey of research to this understanding of cancer as a metabolic disease?
Yeah, well, thank you. You know, we've been working on biochemistry and genetics for decades in relationship to a broad range of diseases. You know, I worked on the lipid storage diseases, Tay-Sachs disease, you know, Sonhoff's disease, these kinds of ganglioside storage diseases. I've been working on those, trying to develop therapies and methods to manage these childhood gene, these are inborn errors of metabolism, gene-based inherited disorders. And then we've worked on in the field of epilepsy for many decades, looking at animal models that replicate what goes on in humans with epileptic seizures. And then, of course, our work on cancer. And these are parallel endeavors in the lab. So sometimes what we find in a lipid storage disease has implications for seizures, and then sometimes what we see in the epilepsy field has implications for cancer and vice versa. So we were using all of these, looking at all these different diseases, and we started to see some commonalities in overlapping and what we were looking at. And in epilepsy, we knew for decades that the ketogenic diet could stop what we call refractory seizures, seizures that are very difficult to manage with drugs. The problem is, of course, was the mechanism of action. And of course, the medical profession would prefer to administer drugs rather than what we would consider complicated diets. But the work of Jim Abrams and the Charlie Foundation really exploded the ketogenic diet field in the epilepsy area, and now that has just overflown into all these other areas. But in the epilepsy field, you know, we were able to show that whether you have a ketogenic diet or just water-only fasting or therapeutic fasting, you could get the same results. The seizures would be blocked. So and it was always associated with a reduced glucose and an elevated ketone levels in the blood. And it was very interesting. Some children, and I used to speak to John Freeman, the late John Freeman, one of the founders of the ketogenic diet therapeutic approach to epilepsy. And he told me that you every now and then you find a child who loves the ketogenic diet and eats so much of it, like really enjoys it. Now, this doesn't happen very often, but it does happen. And invariably, the seizures in these children are not managed at all. And we found the same thing in the mice. If we gave the mice ketogenic diets without restriction, they had no benefit to seizures. And as a matter of fact, they have no benefit to cancer either. And what we found is that if you take in so much of this stuff, it's not healthy. And it has to be restricted or at least monitored with respect to blood glucose levels. And whether it's cancer or epilepsy, you need to maintain the low blood sugars as low as you can get them, and as high, and ketones as high as you can get them. And ketones can't go that high in healthy people. These are people that don't have diabetes, of course, type 1 diabetes. So it's important. Most of us can't get our ketones that high because we will pee them out of our body. You know, we just, you know, but if you can get them into the 3 to 4 millimolar range, this is really good, and glucose can go down. And this really applies to managing epileptic seizures and also cancer. But through different there's different mechanisms by which the diet blocks seizures. And we're really not sure how the diet blocks seizures. This is an active area of investigation. But we clearly know how low glucose and elevated ketones can block epileptic, can block cancer. That's for sure. We know that. The problem is, you know, unfortunately, the oncology field is very resistant or refuses to know this, and this is one of the problems.
So I just want to kind of step it back a bit to what you were saying with epilepsy, because I remember in our very original conversation, I shared with you that I saw a movie many, many years ago now. I mean, it must be 20 years ago. And it was a true story, and maybe that's where the Charlie Foundation came from. It was a true story of a child who started developing epilepsy and then went the traditional medical route and got more and more compromised because all the drugs were now increasing his seizures until he was hospitalized. And then he was kidnapped by his mother out of the hospital because they wanted to do brain surgery on him, and taken to a center that was working with a ketogenic diet. And then this child recovered. And I think that, that was the beginning of my awareness of the role of this ketogenic diet, which we'll talk about in more depth. But I think you were involved in that originally.
Well,
that was a true story.
It's based on Charlie Abrams, the son of Jim Abrams.
Right.
And Meryl Streep was the actress in that movie. I can't remember the father's name. He was another actor. But, you know, most people know who Meryl Streep is.
Right.
And she was a friend of Jim Abrams, so they got this to be made. And she went to the Johns Hopkins. They brought Charlie to the Johns Hopkins, where my friend John Freeman at that time was the leader in the field. So, and Millicent, she was the dietitian there. I can't remember her last name. But she treated Charlie, and she was the one, and she was featured in the film, actually. At John, the name of the film was First Do No Harm. It was a really interesting movie, but it showed you the resistance of the establishment to alternative or complementary therapies, and that resistance is just as strong today as it was then. Just as strong today in the cancer field. I don't know if it's just as strong in the epilepsy field. My colleagues who work in the epilepsy field are, you know, pushing to have metabolic therapy used as a first course of action. And if that doesn't work, maybe drugs could be brought on. But I would say in about more than 70% of pediatric epilepsy clinics, they'll offer drugs first. And sometimes the patients want that. You know, they don't want to be restrictive in what they eat. The child can sometimes be, you know, crying and very, very resistant to these changes. But many children adapt quite readily, and their seizures are managed in a much more effective way than with high-dose drugs, which have their own series of adverse effects that you would like to try to avoid. So you're right. I mean, but the concept of ketogenic diets for epilepsy is now spilled over into Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, cancer, and all these differences, and all these many other kinds of diseases as well. And people are saying, well, you know, is this a panacea? Could it be, you know? And Cheryl, I'll tell you, what the ketogenic diet does, and we don't like the term diet, it's ketogenic metabolic therapy is basically what it's called. Mm-hmm. It just brings the body back into a healthier state, a state that is closer to how we evolved as a species. You know, our ancestors did not have access to high processed carbohydrate foods, and you know, they were mostly eating meat diets, you know, heavily carnivored, and plants and things like this, whatever they can get a hold of. But it wasn't high carbohydrate, high glycemic foods. And so basically our ancestors were always in a state of semi-ketosis, but, you know, they suffered other conditions. You know, they suffered from deaths from viruses and infections and fighting and whatever. We had no antibiotics, so a lot of people died from they died from infections. But they didn't die from cancer, and they didn't die from, you know, from Alzheimer's disease. You know, people could argue, well, you didn't live long enough. But there was people that did live long, and those kinds of diseases were rare, if at all. I mean, you can look at Albert Schweitzer, the great physician humanitarian, when he was working with African tribes. He noted that they don't have cancer. And the Eskimos, when they were first, you know, evaluated, they didn't have any of a word for cancer. Now these folks are just as prone to cancer and all these other inflammatory diseases as the rest of us, mainly because they're now consuming these highly processed, nutritionally depleted foods, and you put yourself at risk for all kinds of chronic inflammatory diseases.
So we're paying the price for how the food industry has hijacked our high-quality, truly nutritious food, and then get us hooked up because sugar is so addictive in whatever form it comes into. So as we've changed our diet, we've seen the skyrocketing of the statistics of these metabolic diseases like Alzheimer's, cancer. Before we go any further, can you give us your definition of what ketones are? So I want everyone to understand, when we talk about a ketogenic diet, what actually we are talking about, and then we can proceed from there. But I want to make sure people know what you mean by a ketogenic diet.
Yeah, well, a ketogenic diet is simply a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet. And when you eat the fat, it goes to the liver, usually a medium-chain triglycerides. These are, 12, carbon 12 hooked to a glycerol backbone. Now, the liver, it's like a wood chipper. So the liver will take these. Now, obviously, as blood sugar goes down, you have insulin going down and glucagon, the other hormone, goes up, and it facilitates the breakdown of these fatty acids into ketone bodies. Ketone bodies are simply small segments of fatty acids, but they're water soluble. You see, fats are not water soluble. They form these micelles. They form these little vesicles of fatty acid, fat material. But ketone bodies are water soluble, so they can go right into the bloodstream. So they're short little segments of fatty acids. They're called acetoacetate or beta hydroxybutyrate. These are terms for fatty acid breakdown products, and they're called ketone bodies. The interesting thing is that nobody really knows why they would call ketone bodies. And as a matter of fact, people say, why do you call them ketone bodies? And the answer is we really don't know. I mean, I tried looking into this, and there was some obscure thing. But they're actually, small, water-soluble byproducts of fat metabolism. And they can pass through and be used as an energy source for all most of our organ systems, especially the brain and the heart, but not the liver. The liver makes them but doesn't use them. It's very interesting. So our body is like a division of labor, and don't forget, when we would not have access to food, how is the brain going to survive? Energy user in our body is the brain, and brain burns sugar, loves to burn sugar. But if we don't eat and have no access to sugar, we don't go unconscious, and that takes several days for the body to recognize that food is not coming into the system. So we start to break down our reserves. Reserve energy is fat, and the fat is stored in adipocytes in our body. Everybody knows, you store it in your gut, your butt, your muscles, and you have fat storage all over the body. So when we stop using gluten, when we stop eating food, drinking water, then the body starts to mobilize these fats. Or you can take a ketogenic diet. In other words, you can take a diet that has the fat already. You don't have to be mobilizing it out of the adipocytes. However, when you do start taking these diets, interestingly enough, the adipocytes lose fat. This is why one of the effects of taking a high fat, low carb diet is you lose weight, and you lose weight because the body is recognizing that we're not getting sugar. So not only do the fats come into your body from the diet, but they also begin to be mobilized out of adipocytes. So you lose weight. You lose weight on a ketogenic diet. And people always say, well, how are you going to lose weight if you're eating only fat? But that's the absurdity. You don't get fat from fat. You get fat from sugar. Sugar is converted into fat. And if you can't burn fatty acids right away, you excrete them. So you either burn fat or excrete fat. You don't store fat for the most part, okay? So it's sugar that's being stored as fat, not fat. So you eat fat without sugar and you lose weight. It's amazing. But at the same time, you produce all these little ketone bodies, which are water-soluble breakdown products. And the heart gets really, really healthy when you're burning ketones. They can burn fatty acids, but ketones have a unique capability of enhancing the energy efficiency of mitochondria in cells to a greater degree than can glucose, the sugar, or even fatty acids. And that's what makes these little ketone bodies so powerful in giving us a healthy homeostatic system.
And when you talk about mitochondria, for people who may not be familiar with that term, I mean, those are these a form of bacteria that's inserted itself into our cells that are responsible for generating energy, energy for every single function of our body. So our body cannot work if we do not have healthy mitochondria, which is why they are so important and so critical for our well-being, as well as to support them so we can heal, because there's a dysfunction of those energy-producing cells, the mitochondria, in all of these chronic conditions.
Yeah. Well, and not only that, they're responsible for the evolution of most metazoan species on the planet. A metazoan is a multicellular organism. And you're right about they were a type of bacteria that could obtain use oxygen to facilitate energy production. And before oxygen came into the atmosphere some 2.5 billion years ago, the organisms that existed on the planet were one-celled organisms that would simply proliferate as much as they could, and then they would die. And they would die anytime you would remove ferment, because that without energy made without oxygen is called fermentation. And all the organisms on the planet at that time were fermenters, because there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. It was only after these bacteria were able to, start producing the oxygen that we began to have an atmosphere, and that allowed a fusion between one type of bacteria and the fermenting bacteria that allowed cells to form metazoans. Metazoans are multicellular organisms, and all the mammals and all the complex organisms we have today are the result of the development of mitochondria. And the mitochondria are the organelle. It's an energy factory inside the cells. And it's like a spaghetti network. It's really quite remarkable. So they look, when you cut the cell in half, they look like little jelly beans, something along these lines. But that's like if you cut a spaghetti, right in half. But if you cut it lengthwise, they have a very different appearance. But the bottom line is that they're like a spaghetti network throughout the cytoplasm of the cell, and they regulate ionic balances within the cell, and of course produce energy using oxygen, and very efficient way of generating energy. So each cell in our body can perform a unique defined function. Liver cells do one thing, colon cells do another, brain cells do another. So these cells can have different activities within the different organ systems, because they have great ease to produce energy, which is ATP. So the mitochondria are responsible for not only producing ATP, but maintaining the normal functional activity of the cells in any given organ. Okay, so. And they can differ a little bit from one organ to the next. I mean, we've seen this. But basically, they are highly energy-efficient systems that allow cells to perform their normally scripted functions, okay? So liver does one thing, brain does another, colon does another, breast does one thing, skin does another. Yet they all have to have energy, and that energy comes from the mitochondria, and the mitochondria generating the energy from the air we breathe. Cancer cells are very different. They generate energy without oxygen. So the cancer cells fall back on the ancient pathways that existed before oxygen came into the planet, and they grow out of control. So mitochondria are essential for maintaining what we call the differentiated state of the cell, the normal physiological state of the cell.
And in your research, what have you found to be the key switch that turns off the healthy functioning using the mitochondria and its ability to generate energy to that more primordial form of energy that causes cancer?
Yeah, well, that's an important point, and that was referred to by the Nobel laureate Albert Szent-Györgyi as the oncogenic paradox. And he argued, we've solved the paradox. He said, how is it possible that you can get cancer from so many different kinds of provocative agents? Like, for example, we know we have what we call carcinogens. These are chemicals that are known to cause cancer. A woman or may get breast cancer from being having an exposure to a chemical carcinogen. Another woman may get the same type of breast cancer never being exposed to carcinogen, but having intermittent hypoxia or chronic inflammation. And then other people may get it from an inherited risk factor, like a BRCA1, they call these genes. These genes are risk factors. If the mutation, the inherited mutation, alters the function of the mitochondria, that person is at a higher risk for developing breast cancer. But another person having the same mutation may never develop breast cancer because in that person, the mutation never affects the mitochondria. Carcinogens are chemicals that damage the mitochondria ability to make energy through oxidative phosphorylation, the normal way the cells breathe. They take in oxygen. Intermittent hypoxia can cause cancer. Some people get cancer from viral infections. They're called oncolytic viruses, right? Papillomavirus, hepatitis C virus. These viruses enter the body. They target certain kinds of cells, and they damage the mitochondria in these cells. So all of the provocative agents, radiation, people know, hey, well, you don't want to get exposed to radiation. Why? Radiation causes cancer. How does radiation cause cancer? It damages the mitochondria in the cell. Any cell that has chronic damage to the mitochondria run the risk of developing cancer. Either the cell will up and die, or if the disruption of oxygen utilization is not too acute but chronic over many, many years, possibly decades, the cell changes back to, as you said, the primordial condition. And that primordial condition is a gradual shift from generating energy through oxygen as opposed to shifting to energy generated from the ancient pathways of fermentation. And as I told you, all the cells that existed on the planet before oxygen came into the atmosphere 2.5 billion years ago had what we called unbridled proliferation. These cells naturally grew like crazy, and they would grow like crazy as long as fermentation fuels certain amino acids and certain kinds of fermentable fuels were present. When they used up that, they would die. The cancer cell is doing the same thing. It's lost its ability to generate energy through the normal respiratory system and falls back on these ancient pathways that exist in all the cells of our body. It's just that they're very, very minor now, but chronic damage to respiration causes the cell to fall back on these ancient pathways, which then leads to unbridled proliferation and cancer. The definition of cancer is cell division out of control. That's the definition of cancer, cell division out of control. And the cells that existed 2.5 billion years ago when there was no oxygen in the environment, in the atmosphere, it was cell division out of control. So basically these cells are falling back on pathways that just allow them to grow out of control. But the interesting thing is that the fuel that allows them to grow out of control, these are fermentable fuels. And we and others have defined only two fuels can be fermented, and that is the sugar glucose and the amino acid glutamine. So we know now these cancer cells cannot survive without fermentable fuels, and that those fermentable fuels are glucose and glutamine. So it doesn't make any difference what kind of cancer. If it was caused by a virus, or caused by a carcinogen, radiation, rare inherited mutation, blah, blah, whatever it is, these cells enter into a fermentation metabolism, and they grow out of control. So, and all the cancers are the same. People say, oh, we're going to treat your cancer is different from it. They're all the same. These people who say things like that lack knowledge. They don't understand the biology of the system. So lung cancer, colon cancer, brain cancer, breast cancer, bladder cancer, they're all the same. They're all the same because they're fermenters. And we showed this. So we solved the oncogenic paradox. We showed that all cancer cells have the same underlying defect. They need fermentable fuels to grow and divide out of control. So the way you can manage cancer, now that we know this, is simply deprive the tumor of the two fermentable fuels, and we should be able to significantly reduce the growth of tumors, regardless of where they are or where they came from. as long as we can restrict the availability of the two fuels needed for their survival, which is glucose and glutamine. You know, when you say things like this, people say, well, it can't be that simple, can it? And the answer is, yes, it can. It's just that, well, it's so simple, how come no one's doing this? And then you have to ask, well, why are we not doing that? And people, and that's the big question, why are we not doing this?
Well, and that kind of has some obvious answers when you understand the industry that has grown around cancer.
Well, I understand that.
I just want to kind of reiterate what you just said, because it really is so profound, Tom. So basically, your cells are, or let's say your mitochondria are damaged from exposure to chemicals, to viruses, to extreme trauma and stress, to a poor diet, to high sugar addicted, you know, diet.
Right.
They are going to damage the mitochondria, which generates the energy and the oxygen, and revert to this fermentation type of process, which goes back to those early 2.5 billion years ago cells. It's like they regress back to this uncontrollable growth process, because the cells have been so compromised for whatever reason. And that's the bottom line of why we are dealing with wherever in the body that may show up. I don't know why some areas are more prone than others, but the underlying mechanism is the same. You've starved your body of the mitochondria's ability to generate the energy, and the body and the cells have to revert to a more primitive form, causes uncontrolled proliferation of cell growth, right? So, this is why we have created this epidemic. We've created it by exposure to these chemicals, which are everywhere now. We've created it by choosing the foods that are sugar-based, and we have to remember that all carbohydrates, breads, grains, all turn into sugar in the body, which also then generates more inflammation and more damage to the cells of the mitochondria. And so it goes, right?
Yes. Yes. And a good example of this is our relationship with the chimpanzee, our closest biological relative. And when you look back, the human and the chimp, we evolved from a common ancestor. We have a common ancestor that preceded both the chimp branch and the human branch. And when we split from the common ancestor, our ancestors started to change the environment in a way very different from what the chimp did. And if you go today and you look at chimps in the zoo or chimps in the wild, the chimpanzee is 98% similar to us in protein and gene sequences. So you have a difficult time trying to determine, if you didn't know what species you were looking at from a gene sequence or a protein sequence, unless you were told, oh, that's a chimp and this is a human. Oh, really? Oh, that's interesting. But they're very similar to us in gene and protein sequences. And yet cancer is extremely rare in chimp. There's never been a documented case of breast cancer in a female chimpanzee. Why the chimp who has the same genes and the same proteins as us never gets cancer, and we're losing 42,000 women a year with breast cancer, and you have all these cancers in humans, and our closest relative has no cancer. And the answer, you say, well, what could be responsible for this? Well, the chimpanzee is eating the same foods that they ate when they first evolved as a species. Our ancestors, the foods we're eating today are very, very different from what our ancestors are eating. And like you said, Cheryl, I mean, our diets and lifestyles are so strikingly different today from our ancestral origins. And the chimp is essentially staying the same. So does that mean that if we go back and do a Paleolithic diet, don't forget our ancestors were were active. They walked around. They did a lot more activities than we do. They weren't driving cars. Now, the question, of course, is that you can't directly test this hypothesis because when I went to the zoo, I asked the zookeeper there where they had some chimps. I said, these chimps get a very restrictive diet. They eat they're very monitored in what they're eating. They're making sure that their diets are quite consistent with what they would have in their natural environments. And I said, what happens if you give the chimpanzee pizzas and big jelly-filled donuts and high carbohydrate Cokes and put them on, take them off their ancestral diet, and let's put them on the Western diet? And the vet said that would be animal cruelty. So
funny about that.
So we can't do the experiment. They would arrest you for perpetrating cruelty on this poor chimpanzee. The problem, of course, is would the chimpanzee like to eat the pizza and drink the Coke? Yes, they love it. The one guy says he has a pet chimp. He says the chimp loves Chinese takeout. You know, if given the opportunity, I think these animals would love to eat the same stuff that we eat. But you know, they're either in the middle of the jungle. They're not going to drive down to a local, Dunkin' Donuts or get a Papagino's pizza. And neither are the ones in the zoo. I mean, so they're not being exposed to the diet and lifestyles that we are, and yet we're devastated by all, as you said, all these chronic diseases. It's not just cancer. I mean, you have Alzheimer's, you have type 2 diabetes. You may have an epidemic of type 2 diabetes. You know, type 2 diabetes is very rare in these animals. And they're also, as I said, these conditions were extremely rare in Aboriginal populations, right, in Africa and Eskimos and Australia. I mean, the Aboriginal peoples generally didn't get cancer. So all of these diseases are the result of a modern-day diet and lifestyle changes that put us at risk for all these different diseases. The important issue is that you need to recognize that, okay? Then people have the choice. You can make a choice. The chimps don't have these choices. We have the choices. But, you know, that knowledge can possibly be valuable to some people. And then some people don't care. I mean, what are you going to do?
You know, when you describe this, Tom, it's like a blinding flash of the obvious, I have to say. But because of your research and the depth of your research, I mean, your book, Cancer is a Metabolic Disease, is a tome. I mean, it's, you know, geared towards more of the health professionals, because I mean it's huge, it's expensive. I mean, you go into great detail and depth. Are you still there?
Yeah. So yeah. Well, the problem is that it's slowly moving the field, it's too disruptive. It can't. The issue here is financial revenue generation. But people have to know that the solution to the cancer problem is quite obvious. I mean, the problem is how you replace one form of therapy that's highly profitable with another form of therapy which right now is not as profitable. And the answer is we have to it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible, terrible thing to say that the suffering, poisoning and irradiating and doing all these horrible things to people is necessary to maintain an economic system. And basically, that's basically what it is. The cancer patient serves the economy. You know, they want to be treated with all these very expensive things, but we get 1,600 people a day dying from cancer in pretty horrible ways. So to sustain an industry, and as long as people understand that and are acceptable with it, then they, you know, there's
That's
nothing you
choice.
Can really do about it.
Yes. Yes. And I mean, yes, we know that there is a vested interest in what you're, research has shown, and what you are advocating is really empowering people to make the lifestyle and dietary changes that will correct what you know, injustices they have done to their body, and then put them on a path for health for the long term.
Yeah, well, you're talking prevention here. This is prevention.
Yes. So, Tom, will you give us some ideas of how to eat a ketogenic diet? What is it that should be foundational foods for people who really don't know anything about it but are really curious and want to start on this journey? And I know there are lots of books written about it, but if you could just give us some pointers of what are the foods that you have found to be optimal in helping to create a more ketogenic response, and which are the definite no-nos? I know you talk about fats, and I think we can start by saying which fats are the healthy ones and which ones are the poison ones.
Yeah, well, it's sometimes hard to say. We developed the glucose ketone index calculator here at Boston College, which allows individuals to know whether or not they're in a state of therapeutic ketosis. So obviously, getting the body into a state of therapeutic ketosis, you can arrive at that state by doing a variety of different things. You know, one way to do this is just do water only fasting. Don't eat any food, and just drink water. And people say, well, you got to be nuts to do this. Well, there are people that actually do it. Guy Tannenbaum, who's all over the web with his management of advanced prostate cancer. He did these 18-day water-only fasts for several times a year, and you know, he was able to get his blood sugars down and his ketones up, which is what the purpose of fasting is to become healthy. So you can get, if you want, it doesn't have to be, the purpose of a ketogenic diet is to bring you into a state of therapeutic ketosis. Okay, so how do you get into the state of therapeutic ketosis? Well, one way is not eating. Okay, just drink water for a certain period of time. And then when you do start eating, you eat low glycemic foods, foods that are very low in carbohydrate content and have low glycemia, which means glycemic index is how fast does a carbohydrate in the particular food you're eating turn into glucose. So, you know, there are some plant-based complex carbohydrates that are not immediately converted into glucose. There are others, you know, some fruits have high sugar content, which can inadvertently be converted into sugar. The higher the sugar, the lower the ketones. So you know you have to bring glucose and insulin down in order to get into therapeutic ketosis. So, and it can vary from one person to another. Some people can get into therapeutic ketosis on a purely carnivore diet, just eating meat and fat. Okay, and we've seen this plan. This is called the Paleolithic, sometimes called the Paleolithic ketogenic diet. Other people can do it on a vegetarian diet. So I eat small amounts of plants, eat small amounts of vegetables, and this kind of thing. And how do you know this? You just measure your glucose, use the glucose ketone index calculator, and that'll tell you whether or not the diet that you're eating is producing therapeutic ketosis. You can buy these meters now. They have the Precision Extra meter from Abbott, or the Keto Mojo glucose ketone index meter. You can buy these on Amazon. You can look them up. You know, you can get either one of them. The Keto Mojo is one where they've put in a chip where you just push the button and it will give you your GKI value without having to use a pencil and a paper to calculate the ratio. It's a very simple ratio. Anybody with a fourth grade education can calculate these ratios. But they even made it simpler for the Keto Mojo. So, and as I said, you buy them on Amazon. So when people say, oh, what can I eat to get into therapeutic ketosis? Well, try to eat something and see what it does to your ratio. And if it keeps your ratio high, don't eat that. How should I do this? Well, try doing intermittent fasting, and then when you do eat, you know, eat some food that has very low carbs and low glycemia, and see if that puts you into therapeutic ketosis. And then you can experiment. Every human being can experiment to achieve a therapeutic ketotic state with foods that they might like. Avocados are great. You know, there's a variety of different foods. And if you want vitamin C, grapefruit is wonderful. Grapefruit provides the vitamin C, but it has extremely low glycemic index, so it's not going to throw you out of ketosis. And we learned that from the epilepsy field. So a lot of the foods that the people in epilepsy are maintaining their seizures were brought over to the cancer field. Where in cancer, we're much more flexible, I think, to get into therapeutic ketosis. We're working with a patient now. We're ready to publish the paper. He's out almost 7 years now with a glioblastoma brain tumor. And he was more on salmon. He was eating salmon and sausages and bacon and these kinds of things. And he was in therapeutic ketosis. Other people may who can't eat. We also know that there's cultural differences. People from India, people from the Western, different people have different cultures. The Asians, you have to have diets that are going to be culturally acceptable as well. So the field of therapeutic ketosis and what kinds of foods you should and should not eat will be culturally adjusted. And I think with the glucose ketone index calculator, you'll know what you can and cannot eat. And that can vary from one person to the next. So it's hard to say what I should eat to get into therapeutic ketosis unless I have the meter there to tell me what I can and cannot eat. So it's and it's kind of fun for everybody to figure out, what kind of foods they can and should eat versus ones that they probably should avoid.
Well, it sounds like there's so much flexibility in the foods that can put a person into ketosis. And I guess maybe it's starting on the other side, which is saying that if people remove the processed foods from their diet, if they remove the sugar foods, the diet-free foods, the foods that are high in sugar and fruits that are high in sugar, if that can be removed from your diet, then you're actually on your way to ketosis, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's just as you explain it and you helping people to understand and educate people, it becomes so obvious that we have driven these chronic conditions by the choices we've made and exposures to chemicals, which is why we want to clean our environment, our personal space out, and just replace the foods that are generating high insulin spikes because of the sugar with real food, vegetables, low glycemic fruits like apples and grapefruits, like you said, plus
I don't know. Cheryl, I don't know about apples. I can't.
Really? You think apples are not low enough?
We've selectively bred apples to be quite sweet. The original apple was a little bitter thing. Our ancestors may have not enjoyed. We've selectively bred all these different fruits, so you got to be, as I said, see what it does to your GKI. If you say, well, let me eat this apple for lunch instead of a sandwich, and you measure your GKI before you eat the apple, and then measure it after you eat the apple, and if it throws if it elevates your blood sugar, don't eat the apple.
That's what's so fascinating is that we can start monitoring ourselves, right?
Yeah. See, the thing now is we have the tool. We now have a validated tool, which is very simple. That's glucose ketone index calculator. Will that allow us to know whether or not the food that we are eating is going to maintain a mild state of ketosis or not? My friend Dom DiAgostino, who's really big in this field as well, he's always in a state of therapeutic ketosis. Dom is very, very cautious about what he eats, and he has a variety of foods. He'll eat organic meats and eggs and all kinds of stuff. And the kinds of vegetables that he eats are always low glycemic. So he's always in a state of mild therapeutic ketosis. And I think, if people are aware of this, they can use the same tool to determine their level of ketosis.
I have a question. There are thoughts around an acid alkaline balance, and we should be more alkaline, and so people have concerns about eating too much protein, for instance, as creating more of an acidic condition in the body. How do you reckon that kind of information?
I don't listen to that. We evolved it. We're
yeah.
carnivores from the beginning. Obviously, no, there was no cancer. So our bodies, we have a very, very powerful system to maintain pH balance. Don't forget the enzymes in our gut and the enzymes in our tissues work in a very narrow pH range. So we balance this out. This is all balanced. So I'm not, you know, there are carnivores out there, people who only eat meat, they never eat any vegetables, and they're in perfect balance. So you know, as I said, you know, it's just look where we came from. We're omnivores. We can eat anything in the environment that walks, crawls, or flies, okay? And even eat each other in the past. You'll eat your dogs and cats. You'll eat anything that you can get a hold of. That's why the flexibility of our body is so incredible. So, you know, eating just plants all the time or eating just meat all the time is you can do that, but, you know, I don't know if it's the best thing. But again, I mean, how do you feel? The bottom line is your weight balanced? How do you feel? people who get into these states of therapeutic ketosis generally feel a hell of a lot better than they did before they were in those states.
Well, first of all, I would imagine people have more energy, right? And that's a big one. That's a sign of health, is more energy. And then that would lead to more mental clarity, more mental energy. So your thinking is better, your moods, and it, you know, just this whole progression of what health is really all about, which so many people have no idea of what a real state of wellness feels like because they've been so compromised.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
As I said, the food industry, you know, has produced foods that are so incredibly tasty. Let's be honest. I mean, when you're eating some of those highly processed foods, to a lot of people, I mean, you eat a jelly-filled donut. Are you kidding me? I mean, you ever taste some of these donuts from some of these specialty shops, like Krispy Kreme and these things? I mean, sweets that are delicious. I mean, you're not going to We're living in a society where we have a lot of very, very tasty foods, some of which are okay, some of which are nutritionally deplete, but they taste so good. And another thing is they're cheap. So for people who don't have a lot of money, you know, they will gravitate towards these cheap, very tasty foods. And eventually the body will go into a state of, as you said, like systemic inflammation, putting the body at risk for a variety of different chronic diseases. But you're right. I mean, but if you ever taste organically grown lettuce and tomatoes, I mean, the flavor is just is better than any of these processed things. But, you know, it's hard for people. What are they going to go out? Everybody's going to go out in the backyard and put up a little garden. I mean, you know, people in the cities, I mean, it's just the convenience of having the foods available that may not be nutritionally balanced. And, you know, so there's a lot of issues here that are associated with good health or poor health. And but as long as people are aware of these things, then at least that's a step in the right direction.
So glucose ketone index chart, where do we go to get that chart?
You'll see a lot of that on the web now. We developed the glucose ketone index calculator for cancer patients, specifically brain cancer patients. It took off in a direction that I did not anticipate, and that is people who just want to stay healthy and lose weight and look good. And you'll see a lot of people, a lot of these health apps, these apps that people sometimes get to be healthy. You'll see the glucose ketone index calculator linked to some of the apps. And I guess it's good, you know, I didn't make it to keep healthy people healthier. We made it to help cancer patients to manage their disease, where they're the ones controlling their destiny. But I see it's all over the web now, the glucose ketone index calculator. And as I said, you have to have a meter that can provide that. The meters can be purchased from Amazon, and the strips. The meters aren't very expensive. The strips, you know, the consumable supplies are always where they make most of their money. But, you know, there's breath meters now, there's urine sticks, there's these things. But if you really want the right accurate glucose ketone index, you need to measure it from the blood. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't like to take a finger prick because you need to get a tiny drop of blood. I mean, people who are diabetics do this all the time. But, you know, some people, oh, is there another easier way to do it? So they're trying to make these different ways to do this, you know, pee on a stick, and if it turns a particular color, you estimate how much ketones. But they're not that accurate. You really want blood measure. And we don't yet have a blood there are some beautiful devices, non-invasive ways to measure your blood sugar, but not your blood ketones. And that's why from the same drop of blood, you can get both measures. But you don't have to be doing it every day. You know, you can do it off and on. I do it occasionally. You know, I'm not one of these guys who are pricking my finger every day. You know, one of the things you like to do is, okay, don't eat for a couple of days. Drink a ketone solution and measure your blood ketones before you do that and your index, and then see how it changes. It's actually quite interesting to see that. I know young people are easy. They can get into these states of ketosis much faster than older people. Like anything else, the young are always more flexible than the older people.
Right.
But but you can still do it. Sometimes it takes a little bit of effort, but get the meters. Look on the web. Now there's guys out there seeing how low they can get their glucose ketone index. You know, one point. Oh, I got a 0.5. Somebody. You know, this is tough to do, but you can do it. You know, it doesn't hurt you. It makes you healthy.
It's just interesting how competitive behaviors show up
everywhere.
You know?
I know.
But
there's a guy. Yeah, they're arguing to see who can get the best GKI value. You know, it's like, give me a break. I mean, just be happy. You're,
well, maybe that's
some
a better way
ketosis.
To be competitive.
Yes,
you know, we've come to the end of the show, Tom. I just want to thank you. I want to thank you for the work you've done, for your commitment to really have, you know, true science, really committed to solutions that are effective, profound, and helping people to not only heal but stay on the right track so they can maintain their health. And you're doing such amazing research, and I'm just so grateful to you and to the commitment that you have and your team to help guide us during these times. So I just want to thank you for everything you do and to have you as a guest on the show today.
Well, thank you very much. And I should point out that we get support for the work we do through Travis Christofferson's Foundation for Metabolic Therapies. Travis wrote the book Tripping Over the Truth, The New Metabolic Approach to Cancer. So, but, you know, people sometimes like to make donations to our research. They can do it through the Foundation for Metabolic Therapies, Travis Christofferson's Foundation. So that keeps us going, and we're still plowing ahead. And as you said, you know, eventually people will come to know most of this. So it'll be very good.
So what is the best website to send people to? Because you have a website, which is tomsafry.com. Is that the best website, or do you have another recommended website?
Well, you know, I think Travis Christofferson's site. Our stuff appears in the scientific open access papers. We like to publish open access papers as much as we can. So that means they're available on the web. Anybody can get them through Library of Science, PubMed, and things like this. They're all open access. But, you know, here at Boston College, people sometimes make donations to keep, and they get information from us just based on the YouTube videos, and I have a Twitter account, and sometimes whenever a new paper comes out, or one of my colleagues, we have a really important paper coming out very soon, where we have a woman who was given up for dead. She was expected to live not more than a month. There's no more we can do. Our colleagues from Turkey brought her back. She's doing very well now.
Tom, I have to cut you off because we're about cut off anyway.
Well, anyway, I'm sorry.
The show.
Yeah.
Thank you. If you can just hang on after we hang up, I'd just like to say goodbye to you. So don't go away. But to all my listeners, I've come to the end of the show. This is a fantastic conversation with Dr. Thomas Safry. Check out the work. And until next time, remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.